Well, this is a... Let's see. Most people...
Big PowerPoint presentation, too.
Oh, good. I got the touchdown sign from Barbara, too. That's nice. It's not even near football season. Open the Senate Revenue Committee. Today, we're going to do a public hearing, and we're going to do SJR 1 first. Folks have been working on this concept, this idea. They're ready to, I think, for the first time at least, take it to a committee and start talking more seriously about an idea and a resolution that they've been working on. And so we'll get them going first, and then when we finish that, we'll do SJR 25. One announcement is we're going to have a busy week of work sessions next week, because we're going to try to work a lot of these bills committee, from urban renewal to the gift card, to the rainy day fund or reserve fund. All of that, it looks like it's all going to need to occur next week. So just an FYI that as we look at next week, it looks pretty busy. Open a public hearing on SJR 1, and Mary, could you give us a brief description? Sure. And we'll go to Councilor Burkholder.
Okay, certainly. SJR 1 proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution that will allow local taxing district to adopt a site valuation taxation system that taxes land at one rate and all other property at a lesser rate. The land tax may be either of two, consist of either of two options: one, a variable rate for land and a fixed rate for other property, or a fixed ratio of the tax rate for land relative to the rate for other property. However, at no time during this period may the rate on land be less than the rate imposed on other property. The proposed site valuation system will be in lieu of a uniform ad valorem property tax system that exists currently, and the tax imposed on land will be exempt from current constitutional limits imposed on property taxes. The proposal allows each taxing district a five-year, what I would call a phase-in period, in order to design and implement their system, and it refers the amendment to voters at the next regular session. The background for this proposal you probably know better than I, because I've only been here for 6 months, but it's based, I believe, on the perspective that land value, particularly in urban areas, is often held for long-term speculation in high-growth areas, and as such, less vacant land is available today for development, which promotes urban sprawl, inflates the cost of vacant land, and raises the cost of public services. Of course, you've got all the additional information here that will be presented that expands on my view, limited.
Well, thank you. That's very helpful. Any questions for Mary? Councilor Burkholder, do you have a team you want to bring up, or it's your show?
Okay. Thanks very much for this opportunity to discuss this issue with you. My name is Rex Burkholder. I'm a Metro Councilor from the City of Portland. It's the district I represent. And an issue that we're very concerned with in the metro area is how do we accommodate the equivalent of two cities of Portland, or actually a city of Portland, in the next 20 years in terms of population growth in our area, and how do we do that and protect the values that we all hold dear, which is having good quality cities, easy transportation, easy access, and the countryside still around us, and maintain that countryside. So we are always looking for ideas of how do we reduce the cost of development and improve the ability to redevelop our communities in ways that can accommodate these people in a way that is a positive for us. And so this is one of those ideas. And what we've done is some research that we'd like to share with the committee, and we appreciate this opportunity to give you this, to have an informational hearing on this. We don't think this is ready to go out. We think it's an interesting and promising idea that we've done some research on. We'd like to work more closely with the committee in terms of developing it some more. This idea has a number of different names. Site value taxation is the one we're trying to focus on and just to coin so we can all talk in the same language about it. But it is an old idea that's been around for a long time, and it's actually in use in a number of places around the world. It would do, the proposal as was described, would tax investment in buildings or development at a lower rate than the land itself. And that's in contrast to our current property tax system, which uses the same rate of taxation in land and development. And in a sense, it does, in a punish people who do invest in their property by raising, making them pay more taxes for that investment. And my part of this starts out from a personal story of mine, is that I, a few years ago, built an accessory dwelling unit, which a mother-in-law apartment is another name for it, a small unit in my backyard, which was one of the something that the city of Portland wants to do, the metro would like to do, get more housing available, lower cost housing, smaller housing available in existing neighborhoods without making big impacts. Well, under our current tax system, what happened with that pulling a building permit allowed the county to come in and reassess my property. And they, so I had a 40% tax increase in with that. And then also I was told by the assessor that, boy, you did a nice job. I get to tax you higher. And it's not that they're evil. It's that our system is set up that that's how they can make sure they can maintain their tax base and such. And yet, to me, it was this idea, well, I'm doing something that is positive, has a social good here, and I'm helping, I'm paying for it, too, at the same time. So, and that's just a small story about how our tax system right now may be doing things we don't want it to do. And so when we look at taxes, they have two purposes. One is to generate revenues for the services we need to provide. And the other one is, of course, to influence behavior towards the goals that we've set as a society. For example, we tax cigarettes. We raise money off it, and that's great, but we also do it because we'd like to have people smoke less. We also use tax breaks to lure companies to locate in our state. For example, the current discussion about giving a tax break to Intel for greater development. Well, that's an appropriate use of our tax system to try and encourage behavior. There's a question that this actually came from a Vermont tax group that was looking at their taxes, and it was a good quote we found to kind of summarize this. And the question they ask of every tax on that they examine is, does the tax discourage or encourage job creation, businesses, and other societal benefits? Does it help to reflect the full impact, economic, environmental, and societal of the tax-related activity? Or does it cause unwanted incentives? And I think that's a good way to look at our property tax system, and is it measuring up under this? Here's another quote from another area that actually uses the site value taxation, which is Pennsylvania, and it's a quote from the Director of Government and Public Affairs of the Association of Realtors in Philadelphia. That states, if you build a nice home in the city, one of your first visitors will be the tax assessor. I learned that. The tax you will have to pay is the penalty for improving the city. The nicer the house, the higher the penalty. Does this make sense to you? A tax on buildings discourages buildings. A site value tax encourages building. It's one of those mind-bogglingly simple ideas that never gets the attention it deserves. Now, in Pennsylvania, it's actually used, and a few other places in the country as well. As I mentioned, we're going to have an incredible amount of growth in our area and throughout the state, of course, in the next 30 years. We estimate about 400-plus new dwellings will be built, new housing units will be built in our area in the next 30 years to accommodate those people. And it raises some really tough questions. How do you accommodate this growth while discouraging sprawl? How do you do that? How can your tax policy encourage positive behavior, that is, the behavior that achieves the goals we have, which are preserving agriculture and forest land, encouraging investment in our existing town centers, and by directing growth to those locations, places where we've made major investments in transportation, for example, in sewage infrastructure, in schools, where the private sector has made lots of investment in its in retail and office buildings. Now, how do we help guide that? Site value taxation, just to give you a quick little history of it, was an idea that came up in the early 1800s of a man named Henry George, who was an English philosopher and economist, and an idea that he was struggling with the same issue. How do you encourage the highest and best use of land? Current versions of site value taxation put the majority of the tax burden on land itself, and it can be revenue neutral in total, that the total tax burden does not change. So it's not a new tax. It's just taking the existing tax and allocating the rate differently. And also, it can be adopted as an option, similar to a urban renewal area, where you can pick a district and say, we want to apply this tool in that area. And so communities that, and actually the resolution puts this as an option for communities to adopt and gives them these opportunities so they can say, on this corridor, for example, a commercial strip where we feel that we should have higher level developments, can we apply this tool in that specific area? Just to give you an idea of where it's used today, Pennsylvania, as I already mentioned, it's used now in the cities of Harrisburg, Allentown, and then it used to be in the whole city of Pittsburgh, but it's been reduced to an urban renewal area. And that in particular, their experience was studied, and their the conclusions of two economists who did the study from the University of Maryland said that site value tax may have helped spur their building boom in the 80s. And that study concluded that site value taxation provides city officials with a tax instrument that generates revenues but has no damaging side effects on the urban economy. That's something that we're looking at. It's not going to save the world, but it does allow you to shift some of the tax burden off of structures and onto land. And when you do that, you're not discouraging new activity, new construction activity. It's also been used for a number of years in Australia, Great Britain, and some provinces of Canada. So it's showing its English roots. It's been used around the old Commonwealth. So when I look at my role at Metro, and when we look at our regulatory structure and our decisions, what I try to always think about is what are those outcomes that we're trying to achieve through the mechanisms that we apply. And some of the things that I think site value taxation does a really good job in the outcomes is I think, one, it's smarter government in the sense that it's providing incentives for behaviors that we want. And it's looking at a tool that one of these various things we do and seeing are we doing it the most effective way possible. The other part is that we think we'd get a higher level investment in the areas where we would like to see it happen, plus the quality would be better. The fact that your tax rate is based on how much you have put into the development actually discourages people from putting a higher quality development. And we think it's also a fairer way of doing the taxation system because it treats everyone equally based on where they're located. The value of land, as Mr. Condor, who's with me here today, will talk about, is really based on how much public investment has gone on. That's why the price of an acre of land in downtown Portland, for example, is higher than an acre of land outside of Burns. In Washington County in the rural areas. The land is, even though they're similarly located in the same geographic area, the investments in roads, in police protection, and all those other things that the public does makes that value of land go up. And so a tax like this would, because it puts more of the burden on the land, would actually then treat everyone equally, not based on how much they've invested, which is our current system does. As it was mentioned by your staff, is that it could help us reduce pressure for expansion of the urban growth boundary, otherwise known as sprawl in some people. And we think that it also increased economic prosperity through incenting investment instead of penalizing that investment. What you have in front of you today is some research that we've done, and I'll finish up with that, describing that. Metro has had, with financial assistance from the Portland Development Commission and a national group called the Lincoln Land Institute, has done a two-part study. Part of that was done with help from students at the University of Portland, as well as some contractors we've used. And we did a study to analyze what would be the impact of adopting this policy in the real world. We actually went out and did two different pieces here. One, the phase one was looked at the general impact that such a policy would place on taxes paid by property owners. We took real properties in five different locations in the metropolitan area and analyzed what would happen if you shifted a part of the rate from the property to the land. Say, instead of 50-50 split, you'd have 60% on the land and 40% on the building, or we did a number of scenarios, or 70% on the land and 30% on the building. So we did a number of examples, and what we found, here's the conclusions of that first phase, was that there was a significant impact in terms of rising property taxes on properties that were vacant. And the property taxes that would be paid by owners of vacant properties would increase between 100 and 150% in four of the five study areas. And it depended, of course, on the zoning as well. We also found a significant decrease in the property taxes that would be paid by multifamily residential properties and industrial properties. There were kind of mixed results in the middle on the single family and commercial properties. Some went up and down, but there were fairly minor shifts in those areas. And all the details are in the study, and I didn't want to get you confused with the details of those numbers. But the general outcome, if we applied this, and this again was through a model, we actually saw that we were getting the kind of outcomes that we wanted to have, was that there would be incentive for redevelopment and not a disincentive for development. The second phase, which is handed out today, is focused on specific corridors. And those are commercial properties along major arterials. And that's a pretty common development form today. You can look at Lancaster Drive in Salem, 82nd Avenue in Portland, West 11th in Eugene. There are areas where you have fairly low-density commercial development, usually one-story buildings and large parking lots. Areas where a lot of times you have the transportation infrastructure, many times you have frequent bus service, but there's not the level of development that we'd like to see happening there. The general finding was that in those low-density and auto-oriented land uses, they're likely to experience an increase in taxes, while areas that have high intensity of a building, such as street-oriented retail and mixed-use apartments, would have a drop in taxes that they would pay. Again, the outcomes that we'd like to see happen would be significantly helped by this. So just to finish up, the site value taxation shifts taxes from buildings and from development onto land. And what we've seen in our studies that you have before you today is that we'll actually see a higher taxes paid by underutilized sites, therefore incenting them to come on the market, and lower taxes on fully developed sites. So again, trying to provide incentives for the behavior we'd like to see happen. And the experience in Pennsylvania and elsewhere has shown that a system like this has led to, in real world, not in a model world that we just done, in the real world, there's been increased investment in city centers, lower land prices in those areas as land comes on the market and out of speculation, and investment in improving existing properties, and then a more intense development happening when development did occur. So we have that definite social benefit occurring without raising overall taxes. And it's very similar, I think, again, to the process we use with our strategic investment tax abatement program, that we're in on a very small scale. And if you want to even take this down to the neighborhood level, the idea of people keeping up their properties, not being penalized for doing that, for making investments, I think is a very important thing for us to think about. So what we're trying to do is create more investment and smarter investment, and we think that this method has been used in other places, has been successful, and we'd like to continue working with the committee, and that's what we'd like to do today, not urge passage of this resolution or moving out, but to have a work session and working with the committee staff to explore this idea further about another tool we could add to our toolbox in terms of improving development in our state. And we're here to answer questions, and then Mr. Condor here is one of our chief modelers and planners and has a long experience with this and can answer more technical questions, which I would defer to him.
Thank you, Councilor Burkhardt. This is not a highly technical question, so I'll put it to you. Do you foresee, if and when you did talk to voters about this, that you would talk about it in a fashion that it would be a tool for cities to use with particular, I mean, you mentioned, I guess, Pennsylvania, where whole cities have taken it and then they've just used it in parts of their city to revitalize some vacant land and provide incentives to revitalize that vacant land. Is that what you foresee, or is it too early to...
Well, again, as the resolution is written, what it does, it provides an option for cities and counties to make a decision about how they would use this tool. And so it really would, I think that this would just provide the permission, and that's the idea, is provide permission for local governments to try out a new tool, and it would be up to that local community to make those decisions about what's the most effective method of doing this and how to apply it. You have lots of questions about what's the relative shift that you would do, where you would apply it, how do you maintain the tax neutrality, that's the goal that you're trying to achieve here too. This is not a revenue generating tool, except you hope to get greater prosperity and have more revenues and wealth created, period. Mm-hmm. So I think that the idea is that you would present it as, here's a tool that could be used for improving our communities, but it's up to the community to decide how to use that.
Mm-hmm. Other questions or thoughts for Councilor Burkholder? Well, thank you.
Great.
I appreciate it. I know we're going to learn more, but we get a lot of ideas thrown our way, and this is one that at least passes that first gate test of, that's interesting. We should look further at this.
Well, if I might, I'd tell a little history of this. Last session, there was all the talk about doing a major tax reform, and we thought, let's get the ideas out there. And since that didn't happen, what we have done is done some research so that we actually know whether this is a good idea or not, and that's what we shared with you today. So that whether this goes forward as an independent package or part of a larger tax reform kind of concept, that's what we'd see it having some value to you. Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the time.
Yeah, thank you. Were you Mr. Condor?
Yes.
You were. Great first name.
He still is.
Still is. First name's Sonny. That's a wonderful first name. Okay, Mr. Wagner, Mr. Smith, and Geonomics, do y'all want to wait, or do you want to come up now? Because we only have three spots, so I just want to structure it so that you get your... Whoever's doing the PowerPoint, why don't we do the PowerPoint? Okay, you are.
Thank you, Senator Deckard. I'm Chris Nelson with Geonomics Consulting, currently residing in Portland. However, I actually grew up here in Salem, so it's nice to be back.
Welcome back, I guess I can say. I live in Portland, too. Barbara, can we dim the lights just a little bit?
Got the screen here. My colleague and I, Tom Gehring, as Rex briefly explained, conducted this study over the last couple of months, looking at, in particular, six commercial corridors in the metro region. Two of these corridors could be described as ribbons. These might be considered zero setback, pedestrian-oriented type of developments. And four of those, as he also described, could be considered more auto-oriented commercial strips. And they were situated across the region, as this map shows. Just briefly, if we look at how the conventional property tax is applied, it's simply the tax rate times the total value. That gives you the tax bill, whereas under a split rate or two rate property tax, the building tax is applied to the building value and then the land tax is applied to the land value. This graph just shows what generally happens as you introduce a land value tax. The blue line represents the land portion and that would be increased, and then simultaneously the building rate would be reduced. And this is known as the building rate reduction method, which we applied in the research to then offset the land portion of the tax by a revenue neutral basis. The as you can see here in this large graph, the overall tax burden may or may not go up. In this one individual parcel, you can see a gradual reduction in the overall rate while the land portion of the tax is actually increased. And we'll see some examples of how this actually plays out in the following slides. So the basic question here is, how can a differential tax rate, which is based on monetary values, actually lead to different development patterns? So the improvement value is actually related to a building's physical size, whereas the land value is much more related to locational attributes and public investments. Our tool here for determining whether the tax shift is positive or negative is known as the land-to-total value ratio. That's simply a fancy way of saying what portion of the property's value is in land. So if we shift that ratio one way or the other, we would have different effects. The effect here is if the land to total value ratio is, say, at 0.4 and the land value is actually increased, then that would actually have a certain effect on the total tax burden. Here in this case, if the building intensive uses would actually experience a lower tax, and we'll see that here in the following slides. So generally speaking, building intensive uses do experience a decreased tax burden, and that is associated with a low to land to total value ratio. The study actually had two parts. The first part was simply to assess what the impact would be on the current development in these corridors, and the second part of the study addressed what would be the tax effects if we applied it to fully developed versus underdeveloped parcels. And we actually focused on the redevelopment scenario on these underutilized parcels. So our assumptions were that, as Rex explained, that this is a revenue neutral effort at looking at these tax effects, and we did not actually use a dynamic analysis of the assessed values. In other words, we simply looked into the future, assuming the assessed values would not change. So just briefly now, I'll run through the current scenario impact by land classes, not by corridors. So out of 253 parcels, single family, including manufactured homes, there would likely be an overall increase in tax burden. Well, why? Because the land to total value ratio in these single family and manufactured home sites would be generally higher than the average for that corridor. And multifamily residential would likely go down in tax burden, as mentioned, also because the land to total value ratio ends up being lower than, say, the average for that corridor. Now, street-oriented retail is a little tricky. depending on the corridor or depending on the extent of the building to the parcel, it may or may not experience a tax decrease. But in general speaking, these are efficient uses of parcels, and so they would show a tax decrease. Similarly here with some parking added, we'll see a couple of cases where the rate may actually cause some of the parcels to experience a greater tax burden. But in general, in this study, because of the revenue neutrality within the corridor, as a land use class, these showed a slight decrease in tax burden. Now, if that assumption were changed and we were to apply this countywide, we may have slightly different results there. Why? Because of the nature of the study, one decrease in tax burden on one site actually then spreads the positive shift across a limited number of parcels, versus if it were applied countywide, it'd be applied to many parcels. And so the tax shift on the positive would probably be much less if more parcels were included to offset that tax decrease on one parcel. Surface parking, naturally, this would follow that the tax burden would increase because it's a low-intensive use of the parcel, and would then be an incentive, as Rex described, to redevelop that kind of site.
So, but are they... Go ahead, Senator Brzezinski.
Yes.
I appreciate that. I mean, I understand exactly how that would work as to surface parking lots,
mm-hmm.
but since there's been so much that has been developed around surface parking lots, then what are we going to do, force it into elevated parking to accommodate the, let's say, the existing as well as the new growth and need for vehicle parking?
Yes, that's likely to be the effect if we actually had available time and funds to conduct more research on this topic. We could look at actual land use shifts, say in such cities as Pittsburgh and Harrisburg, see how those changes might have actually occurred in terms of infill development. But essentially it could, say, imply offering parking, as we'll see here in a slide in a moment, still at the surface but under the building. So it may not actually mean offering subsurface parking or parking structures, but more efficient use of land.
And shifting people more to mass transit, I would assume, as well.
that could be considered a likely effect if such infrastructure were available, yes.
Well, I mean, if I could.
Yeah, please.
I mean, looking at the top 12 tax shift stats, when it talks about the communities that are involved, with the exception of maybe Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, it looks like all the others are what I would consider cities that do have a very high use of mass transit capability. Since of Pittsburgh and New York City. I haven't looked on the back, but yeah.
Thank you.
Well, this would be elective. I mean, it would only be cities that elected themselves into it. So they would have to, I would think they would have to have the infrastructure and pick out. I mean, that's what I have the same question, Senator Pazanski. When you see, you're just trying to think of who are the winners and losers under this. And I think you'd almost get universal. People would like that there's an incentive to redevelop, to make a vacant lot more attractive and more. But I'm just trying to think of, well, who are those folks out there that have these large vacant lots, because they'd have a huge stake in any idea like this. Those would be, I think, the folks who, if this ever started really moving fast, would definitely want to get into this conversation. And what I'd be interested in, I don't know, Rex or if others have talked to kind of that development community and got their input on how they feel about this. Maybe they'd like incentives to actually redevelop.
Well, Mr. Chair, it seems like the whole philosophy is that many people will put a surface lot there to basically pay the rent on the property before it's developed. And so, I mean, I can understand the catalyst that if you're basically going to start taxing on the land, you're going to want to start doing something else besides.
You'll do something.
Yeah.
You'll do it. Yeah.
Interesting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll continue. Just briefly here to look at the difference between the underutilized and the fully developed parcels. What if the underutilized parcels were actually fully developed into mixed-use structures? And look at that here in more detail in a moment. But on the left, you can see the underutilized lots under the land value tax or site value tax would actually experience a tax increase, whereas the fully developed lots on the right two bars, namely the far right, would, as we were about to see, experience a reduced overall tax burden. And again, this is linked to the land to total value ratio, as you can see at the bottom. So what if, as in the study scenario, these underutilized sites were fully developed? We assume that we'd be adding a new residential capacity of about 37,500 dwelling units, including an added value of $8.6 billion in market value assessment. So the redevelopment scenario ends up looking about like this. There would be an overall tax reduction for these underutilized parcels alone. So in other words, we've excluded here the fully developed parcels or undersized parcels that would not qualify for development under this scenario. And that translates to a net reduction of about $19 million in overall tax.
Could you please explain to us, Chris, what would be an example of something that's not meeting the criteria for development? That'd be underdevelopment, I guess you said. I don't know size, but I mean, what type of footprint are we looking at?
Less than 5,000 square feet would be considered too small a parcel for development.
Okay.
Let's take a quick look at a few examples here, applying the general finding that building intensive uses are encouraged by a lower tax burden, and land intensive uses are discouraged by these higher tax burdens. Here's a shopping plaza in Hillsboro. Take a note of roughly the age of this structure here. Perhaps it's early 80s. I'm not exactly sure of the age, but that has a bearing on the improvement or the assessed value here. So with an LTV ratio of 0.40 relative to that corridor's own average land to total value ratio, then this structure would actually see a slight tax decrease. And again, this is in within the assumption of the study of revenue neutrality within the corridor. As we also have heard, multifamily such as this is considered a high utilized site, and even though the land portion of the tax would go up, the overall burden would go down. Here's a kind of maybe a retail professional building combination. It's set back. There is some parking, but a relatively new building. Here we would show a gradual decrease in the burden, so not a lot of incentive to redevelop that site, perhaps. Whereas in this shopping plaza in Beaverton, more extensive parking, older age building, and there we go, slight increase in overall tax burden. Here's an auto-oriented development, fairly land extensive, also a slight increase under the scenario. Now here's a group of single family residences along this corridor. As you can tell, these are fairly small relative to the size of the parcel, and also considered probably older construction. The land actually has a pretty high value on these strips, and because of that composition of the total value, would likely see an increase in overall tax burden and probably lead to redevelopment. Whereas in this single family along Division, pretty extensive use of that parcel. The building covers most of the parcel, you see it's a two-story building that would be relatively flat, so probably not a lot of incentive to redevelop that site in particular. Similarly here, this is a converted residence, obviously well maintained, pretty flat overall effect. Again, the land to total value ratio is for that corridor fairly low. Whereas here, now we have pretty land extensive use and fairly low value building. And sure enough, this would likely show some pressure for redevelopment. Here's an interesting example. There is actually parking included with this two-story structure. Given that the land relative to the improvement is fairly low, then this would probably not show a great degree of redevelopment pressure. And you can probably guess what's happening here. Here we have parking on the surface. It's actually a residential structure. And sure enough, this is a high and best use of that site. And so there would not be pressure to redevelop there. Similarly here, pedestrian-oriented, zero setback, again, probably show a tax decrease and a low land-to-total value ratio. This is actually a fairly old building relative to some of the development, you also see that there's parking available here. And there's actually two parcels in this example, shopping center being on the left. Its land value is very high. As you can see, there are over 700,000 relative to the improvement value. So the ratio is fairly high, and that building would probably see some pressure for redevelopment. Here's now along Southeast Stark, older single-family home. Also pressure for redevelopment under this shift of land tax. Here's a row house kind of structure, single family, fairly high use of that site. likely show a tax decrease. And one of the few...
That's an attractive building there.
One of the few actual commercial, you could say, industrial-type sites along Southeast 82nd, but clearly not a high and best use of this kind of site. Consequently, there would be some positive tax shift here. Similarly, for an auto-oriented sales increase, and you can probably guess what would happen here. So if there's already a market for development, then this acts as an incentive to redevelop these kinds of sites. If there's really no market available, then this kind of incentive taxation probably would have minimal, if no, effect. Now, this is the last slide, and kind of interesting structure in that it's fairly close to the street, as you can see. Not a lot of parking, but two-story. Fairly new, maybe late 70s, I'm not sure exactly, but fairly high use of that site and shows what could actually happen. Not a lot of pressure for redevelopment in that type of view. So it doesn't take a lot of appropriate use of the site to actually show a slight decrease in overall tax burden. So to sum up here, as we've seen, the building intensive uses are actually encouraged by this application of a split rate tax. And there's some other references here for your further information. We actually did conduct a study of the tax incidents in Salem several years ago, and that's also available online if you care for further information. Thank you very much for your time. I hope I haven't gone over, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
That was very helpful. That was very good.
One question.
PowerPoint. Yes, please. And Barbara, can you bring up the lights?
Lincoln Institute of Land Policy, where are they located?
Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Thank you.
Do you know, in Pennsylvania, did they do the same model? And Rex, maybe I have a couple questions. And Rex, you might be a good one to... But do you know offhand, did they do the same... They had to grant cities the ability, and do you see Metro as also having the ability to do this within the entire Metro region? The second would be Rex.
Why don't you answer the first one?
Mr. Chair, sure. Yes, as far as I know, Pennsylvania has applied essentially a local option. That has actually been expanded by initiative in that state a few years ago, so that it can be applied across more taxing jurisdictions.
So the voters of Pennsylvania as a whole weighed in on this and said, yes, this is, we'd like this option to be available to cities.
That's correct.
And on the question about Metro doing it region-wide, that's not, as far as I can understand it, within the ability of Metro. I think what this is it's, again, aimed at the taxing district, and so that could be county, cities, you know, all the way down to urban renewal areas, economic incentive areas. It's based on the option is available to at the taxing district level. And Metro does collect a small amount of property tax, but that's not what we're discussing right now, at least.
So, I mean, I think it's an intriguing concept on redevelopment, on incenting redevelopment. But I'm thinking through, and I know you guys are just kind of starting to gin along here, kind of the, I guess for lack of a better word, the politics of, and just wondering, I mean, it's helpful to know that in Pennsylvania they accomplished the goal of giving cities this tool. But I think what folks would counter with, and I'm interested to hear your perspective, Councillor Burkholder, is this is incenting the type of development, I guess put in the most, how opponents might argue against this in the most explicit manner, is this is basically taking Portland-style development and exporting it to cities and counties that I know they'd have to elect to do it all over the state and penalizing. I mean, I thought of, because a couple of the slides were in my area, which is Alloa and even touching Hillsborough. And I'd like to see those areas redeveloped, frankly. But there might be some sensitivity there, and just wonder how you would cope with that.
Well, Mr. Chair and committee, I think one is the fact that it's an option that would be taken on by each community and how they would design it and where they would apply it to in terms of where they'd like to see changes. And I wouldn't call it Portland style, because I see the same kind of development being desired, Beaverton in the Round, for example, the Gresham Town Center, Hillsborough Town Center is redeveloping. Washington County is looking at a very unusual multi-jurisdictional urban renewal area along the proposed Washington County commuter rail line to achieve exactly these goals. And just like an urban renewal zone, this would be very similar to an overlay in an area that would allow you to see these kind of impacts happening. As you saw, a lot of the slides were not, quote, Portland level. A two-story building with a small parking lot is not, towers along the river kind of thing. So I think what it is, and then also I think you mentioned earlier too about the concern about larger property owners in these areas and their concerns at large parking lots, for example, is that actually most of these areas are pretty highly parcelized. They're fairly small. There aren't hundreds of acres located along these corridors, for example. There actually tend to be smaller parcels of 10, 20 acres at the maximum. So I don't think there's actually people who would be holding huge amounts of vacant land on these areas. Most of them are developed are small parcels. The question is, are they developed at the level that we'd like to see them develop, and are there, since we're taxing them already, should we use that tax policy to encourage a higher level development?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if I turn the coin over, I could actually argue it from the other way of representing the outer suburbs or kind of the suburbs and outer. This actually, I mean, we struggle with how do we make it attractive for some of these developments that actually, one of your slides was along TV Highway, which is in dire need of something. And so I could argue it the counter way of give us this tool to actually provide incentives and work with the landowners to incent something to happen to make those neighborhoods more attractive and more pedestrian friendly and just a better place to do business.
And if I could have to respond to a couple things that came up during Chris's presentation. One is that Senator Brzezinski, when you mentioned about how do you deal with transportation issues, mm-hmm. One thing that we do know that when you get a higher level of mixed-use development, your actual car use drops. We know that it becomes more walkable, too. It's not necessarily needing a huge investment in transit, even though in all the corridors that were studied here are all frequent bus service corridors in the Portland area. They all have 15-minute or better bus service, and so you already have a huge investment in moving people. But these areas tend to be, then you can walk from your workplace to get a cup of coffee instead of having to get in your car and drive over to that place and park, and which is a lot of these kind of developments are that you can't currently, that you have to drive everywhere. And this higher density kind of development or mixed use development allows you to have transportation options in that kind of area.
Yeah, please. I mean, it looks similar. I know in Eugene they talked about nodal development type of stuff, and now they're kind of actually massaging that into something a little bit different than that term. I mean, when I look at this, I mean, it's very unique. I think the chair is, where's the opposition going to come from? And, I mean, there's going to be people that are going to say that something is not right here, even though we see with the perspective and how this could actually for development. And I look at the summary line. It says exempts site value tax from constitutional limits imposed on property taxes. And it just seems to me that you need definitely you have to have that to actually make this work.
Yes.
But I look at who's going to take this out as to maybe what the chair is looking at on the political part. Is this something that we could actually, quote unquote, run out to the voters this cycle? Or is this something that needs to be really developed and evolved to the point of where you have the ability to actually run the campaign that's going to be necessary to inform the voters as to what this and how this actually would benefit a community to be able to do that, as compared to having the naysayers on the daily shows saying, this is basically circumventing what the will of the voters was when they passed Measure 5 or whatever. Any commissioner, any feedback or comment?
Well, Senator Brzezinski and Chair and Committee. No, those are the difficult questions, as you know. It's that the idea is to bring forward some ideas that we think have potential for dealing with some of the major challenges that we have, as I mentioned. And as Chris mentions, that in an area without market demand, this doesn't make much sense. We know we have huge market demand, not just in the Portland metropolitan area, but throughout Oregon. We are growing at a rate much faster than the rest of the country. People are coming here despite the fact that they may not have jobs because it's better than where they're leaving. So we have lots of demand. The question is, how do we do that without destroying what we have here today? And so this is one of those tools that we should consider. And part of the reason of bringing this to you today is to have you help us think about how do we actually get this through the thicket? Because it is. We have to go to a constitutional amendment to change how we collect property taxes. It's an unfortunate reality. It makes it very difficult to tweak the system to make it work better. And that's what I see this as, is very much just a tweak. It's not a major revolutionary change. It's a tweak, but we do have to request a change to the Constitution to make that happen, and that's a big hurdle, I agree. And part of the reason to bring it forward here today is to get these ideas on the table, to talk about it and think about the challenges and things, if are there ways to get around that.
Mm-hmm. Senator and Chairman, if I could also respond to that question. First, Oregon has actually long practiced a form of incentive taxation. It's known as current use assessments versus we actually used to have real market value assessments. Now under Measure 550, we call it taxable assessments. But essentially, this is a form of incentive taxation. It encourages protection of rural and resource lands. And this, in a sense, simply extends that model into a market or a revenue-based tool towards perhaps achieving our stated land use goals. Having said that, we are currently reevaluating what our land use goals are and how to achieve those in the wake of Measure 37's passage. And so there are several questions that I feel and others would probably agree need to be addressed, as you've already raised, Senator Brzezinski. One might be the effect on urban renewal districts. Is there a way to actually enhance those existing districts and even new urban renewal districts? If the Measure 550 limits can be retained but redefined to allow for a split rate property tax, that would also be another area of further research. Whether revenue limits can also work in tandem with this constitutional amendment perhaps may also reinforce the introduction of it. And fourthly, whether this kind of incentive taxation can work as a non-regulatory approach to achieving our statewide land use goals. We have seen some evidence of that being true here, but we certainly haven't yet examined how it might apply, as you're raising, Senator Brzezinski, Mr. Chair, in certain areas, in rural areas or outlying areas of urban areas. So there's more study we believe is necessary. I would also just offer that in Philadelphia, the city council there has recently examined this local option, and the council there actually did a fairly extensive study on its potential incidents. In that process, such groups as the Realtors Association, the builders, banks would clearly benefit by seeing more building. So overall, this acts as a tool to raise the boat. So while there would be obviously some so-called short-term losers and impacts that would be considered negative for certain landholders, by selling or redeveloping those lots, what does that do? Well, it encourages overall development. The tax base broadens and deepens, and lo and behold, the economy really picks up. And I think Harrisburg is a prime example of how that has been borne out.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks.
You know, one other just final thought is, in some ways I was thinking we may be overthinking this a little bit because it is a local option. And generally when you give local options, a lot of the political opposition, not all, but a lot dissipates because you're able to think, well, I get to go back to my local community and make decisions in my community, whether that's Medford or Pendleton or Portland, and we get to decide this for ourselves if this is something we want to utilize. And so maybe the strongest, I guess, attribute, and there's a lot of them, is the fact that it is just completely an option. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, our last panel, Mr. Wagner, Mr. Smith, and former Mayor Williams. And we're almost at our time. We went a little long, unfortunately, or fortunately.
Mr. Chairman, I'm John Williams, former mayor of Oregon City. It won't take me long to say what I have to say because all the experts have said what is appropriate. But I do want to say, just for your own edification, this is not a new idea in Oregon. It was one of the first initiatives on the Oregon ballot under the initiative referendum in 1905, I think it was 1906. It failed. It had extensive debate at that time, however. Why it failed, I'm not sure. I just want to throw in the idea that in downtown in Oregon City and around the environments there, we've had some incidents of what you might call slumlord. It's impossible for them to improve the building because the taxes would go up if they did, and they won't do it, and the city fights with them. They fight back and forth, and it never gets done. This would help answer those kind of problems. And also, I did a little math of my own. My calculator and me were the experts. A number of years ago, I took land values in Oregon City, mostly houses, and tried to find whether that would work in Oregon City in terms of residential properties. And I found matched what they found. Of course, a lot different technique. But in my case, I had built a house which was not of much value according to land I was building on, so I was going to be penalized. But those, as they said, is the bigger the house and the smaller the lot, the more it works. So now we're building McMansions now in Oregon City. Now we're even down to 5,000 square foot lots, so it appears to work for residential too. It appears to have a decrease generally over property taxes over new residential houses built on small lots, but it doesn't work for me. I find, as I talk about this, and I have renewal again, urban renewal is the important connection for me, and as I've been before you before and talked about urban renewal, I think this does what urban renewal is supposed to do, but doesn't tax the people to do it. And I think it's either going to replace or could replace or certainly act in concert with urban renewal and make it really work for the benefit of citizens. I have, if you are interested in the future, I have volumes of information from Pennsylvania and other cities and Australia and the rest of it to share with you. I do wish to correct just one thing, that you ask whether the people had voted on this in Pennsylvania. I don't think they did. I think it was 1920s or something that it was mostly done by legislative action. Now, the people may have done it because they voted for the legislators, but I'm not sure that it actually was a statewide referendum on it. Thank you.
Well, and, you know, if they voted on this and voted it down in Oregon in 1905, I don't know what we're doing here, you know, rehashing that debate from 1905. They've spoken.
100 years ago. It's the rule of law, right?
That's right. That's right. Thank you, Mayor, and appreciate your perspective. And I do see the parallels between the work y'all are doing on urban renewal and this. It's the same issue. Yes, sir.
Okay. Excuse me. Thanks for this opportunity. My name is Jeffrey Smith. I live in Portland, and I've been researching this issue for 25 years. I published The Geonomist, and you might have copies. I have recruited to my organization an economist from the Office of Management and Budget in the White House, and I've been published in many journals and papers, and it was my op-ed that got Jackie Dingfelder interested in this a couple years ago. And I have testified before many groups, including the Russian Duma, which was nowhere near as scary as this group of people. But The Oregonian people, the people of Oregon, are lucky to have you guys consider this. This is one of five states that has a bill to consider this idea this year, and it's tremendously powerful. Not just the benefit you've heard about, but also, well, historically it was mainly for development. But you could use it today to change the dependency on the automobile just through this tax shift. And you see that happening. The mayor of Harrisburg was the second most distressed city in the country when they shifted their property tax. And it drew development into the city, drew millions, hundreds of millions of dollars of private investment into the city. And the mayor of that city, Mayor Reed, gives complete credit to the tax shift for creating that development and doing so, sparing the suburban farmland. Other benefits, affordable housing. Pittsburgh, when it had this system, was cited as being the most affordable major city in the U.S. And was voted the most livable city in the U.S. One of the reasons was a low crime rate. If you have affordable housing, you have stable neighborhoods, so you have low crime. Demographers are always surprised that their crime rate equals that of a small town, and it's mainly through this system. Other benefits, you get the private investment like Pittsburgh, like Denmark. You get greater employment. New Zealand had an employment rate of 99% for 10 years when they had the land tax at a national level. Another benefit is to smooth out the business cycle. The cities in Australia that used this system compared to the cities that didn't, during the last recession, instead of losing less business or breaking even, the cities with the system actually gained new businesses, and that's during a recession. So it's a very powerful antidote to the ups and downs of the business cycle. Every place it's been used, it has worked. Every size of jurisdiction, city, state, nation. So I would amend it, if I were to have any say in the matter, to allow not just cities and counties to adopt it, but the state if it wanted to, a redevelopment district if it wanted to. Every size jurisdiction. Politically, what you're up against is 5 and 50 and 37. This can be an antidote to 37, because as a land tax goes up, the land price comes down. So the compensation package would be less. And people seeing that would probably be fewer claims. Plus, you could make it revenue positive. It doesn't have to be revenue neutral. You can make it revenue positive and have the funds for compensating landowners. And the other benefit is there won't be the demand to develop the pristine locations with this system, because that's going to be attracted to the already built-in systems that have the infrastructure. But you're still up against that grandmother English was on the front page of the Oregonian local section, 90-plus-year-old lady who feels like she had stolen property returned to her when she was allowed to develop her rural location. You're still up against that emotionally. And the only way to deal with that, I think, is to earmark a certain percentage of all the funds you raise for a dividend, like the Alaska oil dividend or the Aspen, Colorado housing assistance. And if you did that, people would have money in the pocket, and then they might feel more comfortable about getting rid of these so-called protections and limitations that basically benefit the speculator more than the homeowner. So, and another way you could improve it is to make payments monthly and make this rebate, this dividend, monthly as well. But presently, the only way you can benefit from land is to own it and develop that particular location, whether it should be developed or not. But if you had a system of land taxes and land dividends, then instead of motivating everybody to develop everything, which would lower the overall land value, you would create a situation where everybody would benefit from optimal land value. And optimal land value includes non-use and parks and keeping the streams open and so forth. In an area that has wall-to-wall development, land value is less than in an area that has parks and open space and healthy environment and so forth. But as an individual owner, you can't benefit from that. The only way you can benefit from that is if you have a system of land taxes and land dividends. If we were to campaign for this, you could call upon some major American icons who have supported this in the past, including people like Einstein, Henry Ford, Eisenhower, many major other ones. So I would recommend actually passing it, getting it out to the Senate floor, having the discussion there, and then, you know, ultimately letting people decide with these moderate, modest modifications. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Yeah, thank you. Questions for this panel?
Just a comment.
Yeah, please.
It's kind of interesting, Mr. Smith. I heard on radio this morning where there's a country, and I forget it, there's a Central America or South America where landowners that are down on lower elevations are actually paying people at the higher elevations to retain their forest so they would not have the sediment runoff. Sure. And for the, you know, it's kind of this holistic approach of taking away that incentive to develop with the long-term impact that it would have on the lower areas.
Interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate all your time and work on this. Commissioner or Councillor Burkholder, you asked for our thoughts and comments at the beginning, and my thoughts, and I guess I've expressed them, are the more this is talked about, and I would avoid terms like land tax, but more as an option. And the SIP is a good model where we've used this and employed this to incent certain types of redevelopment as a local option. And I just think in this building that's going to be a more attractive means of communicating about what you're proposing. Because actually, as you get into the idea, I could see a lot of different groups being very interested. I mean, it was mentioned the bankers and developers and other folks that would obviously be very interested. And revenue neutrality doesn't hurt you, frankly. It doesn't hurt you in describing this because it's not an effort to derive more revenue. It's an effort to really affect decisions and give cities the ability to affect those decisions. Mr. Dobrzanski.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I can just follow up, I would agree with what the Chair said. My biggest concern is to run something out now in what I call premature, because we're going to have one shot at this, and you're going to have the players that are going to be willing to be out there and promote it from their different interests to be part of this process and be on the bandwagon. I mean, once you've got some of these major players who are involved in wanting to see development, and it could be a pretty unique group of constituents that would come together from different political philosophies that I think would work together. But I think to try to move something out and just basically put it out there without having that education and the agreement of some of the major parties to actually be there willing to not only promote by word but also financially the measure, I think it would be premature. And I think once you run it out, if it doesn't get close or pass the first time, it's going to be very difficult to bring it back anytime soon.
Another 100 years.
Yeah, a little while for another 100.
Mr. Vice Chair, any thoughts?
Well, it certainly stimulates thoughts. I happen to have EFU land, a small parcel, and I've owned it 40 years, so I could possibly, under 37, subdivide that. With a policy like this, it would not probably be in my benefit to do that. In fact, I like farming the land. I like using it in its present use. And so I've not really contemplated a major 37 claim. But people like me in the suburban area with EFU lands, I think could get behind a measure such as this. And I think having the discussion in a committee brings some attention to the idea. Having the debate on the Senate floor would be give us much more exposure whether we would pass it on the floor or not. Mm-hmm. I think is an issue. I agree with Senator Brzezinski that it's probably not the right time to run it out, but to at least get the publicity out there statewide, that would not be a detriment, I think. Mm-hmm. So I like the idea. personally. I mean, I think it's a great public policy. We can't persuade the people of that just by our attention to it, but at least having the debate, having it publicized in the media, I think would be helpful.
Mm-hmm. In some ways, I think maybe a Senate floor debate might help this idea, knowing that and working with the House to know that it might not be ready. And Representative Butler and I will meet today, and I might actually chat with him. He's the House Chair of Revenue about this, because I think it's an interesting, as you talk, Senator Starr, and your perspective never occurred to me because I don't own EFU land, but how you would get these coalitions that Senator Brzezinski talked about, where you would get home builders and other builders who are interested because they'd like to redevelop some of these lots with farmers, and you just get and realtors. You'd get a coalition together that sometimes you don't get on other issues because you'd have a mutual self-interest of helping folks keep farming by lowering their tax burden and incenting redevelopment. So I just offer that to you, too, is that something we might want to even think about, is at least you can elevate an issue in this building a couple ways. When you take it to the floor and have it debated, it actually brings it to 30 people, the entire state Senate, and touches all the corners of Oregon. And Senator Starr's perspective, I think, is a very valuable one of his circumstances with Measure 37.
Well, we already incent, as that's been pointed out, we already incent farm and forest landowners by our tax system. Mm-hmm. And I live pretty comfortably on that parcel because, in fact, my tax burden is probably one quarter of what it would be in relation to the value that I have in my property.
Mm-hmm. Senator Brzezinski.
I'm wondering, you know, Commissioner Burkholder, if this is something that you would like to see move forward, let's say, this cycle, whether you'd be willing to try to maybe set up maybe an informative presentation for some of the interest groups that we've talked about. Because I think that would give you a quick snapshot of what type of support you might be able to get together to move something sooner than later. And because, I mean, it definitely has some ideas, and it's interesting when we look at Measure 37 and the discussion that's going on in another committee. I mean, I can see where you could actually utilize this type of approach as Senator Starr says, as an alternative to seeing a lot of people running out claims or trying to in a rush to thinking that they're going to be able to get that quick fix and quick return, as compared to looking at something on a longevity basis of maintaining what I think most of the people that are in those more rural areas really want to do, but they feel that they may be pressured to take the money and run on a short term, as compared to really preserving what they've had in the past.
We'll put this together and get some stuff going, working with your chair.
Great. I mean, one of the nice things is when we're in session, we're biannual legislature, you do have all the interested parties kind of converge on Salem for a six-month period, and so it's sometimes easier to, if you're trying to schedule meetings or schedule folks, it's always easier when the legislature's in session, because outside those halls are most of the folks who have interests in and are represented.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Could we maybe extend our name as a committee to some type of maybe presentation and utilizing one of the hearing rooms, and they could actually promote that and to have the interested parties notified that this is, you know, something that we've looked at and wanted their feedback as well?
Yeah, I'd be happy to say. I mean, when you mentioned, or Senator Starr mentioned, perhaps the Senate floor debate is in order on this, a light went on in my head, which is it gives the proponents here a better forum to, and I'd have to talk to Representative Butler and let him know, because it's a joint resolution, which means it's going to the ballot, and so you have to assure the governor's office and the House that we're not sure if this is ready for the ballot, frankly, but we're ready for a floor debate, at least in one chamber. And I'd be happy to help Councilor Burkholder and his team get some of the interested parties together and facilitate that. And yes,
So the short answer is yes.
Yeah, and I said the one thing, my only hesitation about going to the floor just to basically have an education purpose, I don't think we can do it justice in that snapshot as compared to you actually get the buy-in from some of these interest groups. They'll be able to use their networks to get to all of the members to talk about what the windfalls could be and why they would be supporting it. And then I think having that debate would actually be much more of a trigger point of where we could actually have substantive discussion and maybe actually get some wheels moving to the point of where I can understand what we might want to do on our side to get it over the other side and get buy-in over there. I think you're going to have those interested parties at the table and carrying the pep rally forward.
Yeah. Well, let me do what I'm best at, and that is delegate to staff and ask Mary if she'd work with Councillor Burkholder to, if we want to revisit this. I guess what I'm saying is I'm open to letting the proponents work their magic, and at least on the Senate side. And so Mary is very adept at this, and we'll let you guys go forth. Any Senator Metzger?
No. Through the debate.
Great. Thank you. We will close the hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 1. That is the first resolution, the Senate, that's number 1. And we're going to open a public hearing on SJR 25. Is Senator Molnis Anderson?
No.
She is not here. I do know that. Let's give her a moment. And anyone else who wants to testify on 25? We'll pause for a moment and make sure if no one emerges, we're going to... Harry, do you want to tell us briefly about 25 and buy some time?
SJR 25 proposes an amendment to Oregon's Constitution that enables a taxing district to propose and voters to adopt a rate limit on property taxes that is less than the district's permanent rate limit. Proposes that voters will decide the duration of the rate limit, which can remain in effect for a period up to 15 years. Also requires that voters approve the proposal at a special election held throughout the state on the same date as the next primary election. I wasn't sure of the background, so I called the representative's office yesterday and asked for the gentleman's name who sponsored the proposal, or who was suggested the proposal, and I spoke with him yesterday. And what I found out was that last year or short, but not some time ago, the city of Gresham's city council proposed contracting with Fire District 10 to provide some services to its residents. Apparently, it didn't want to do that within its own, with the previous districts that were serving it. And the use of District 1 would have created a regionalization of services, which would have been cost-effective for the fire district. However, at the time this was proposed, Gresham voters disapproved the proposal because they felt the fire district's maximum permanent rate was too high. So currently there's no... It would have passed had it been lower, apparently. Currently there's no legislation that allows a taxing district to lower its permanent rate, and that was the reason the gentleman explained to me yesterday who was supportive of this bill.
Great. Well, if the proponents emerge and want to come convince the committee, we'll return to this bill. If not, I think I'll just close the public hearing. And this was one of our better public hearings we've had this session. So we're going to close the public hearing on SJR 25 and make sure that's not... Okay. And adjourn the Senate Revenue.